Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We've got some current events, Hollywood news, we're checking in on Taylor Swift, and of course, lots of politics. We're going to start off, we've got two memoriams, but the first is Aubrey Plaza releases a statement on the unimaginable tragedy of husband Jeff Baena's death. This is by Casey Wickman, and it was published on January 7th. Aubrey Plaza has shared a statement following the death of her husband, writer and director Jeff Baena, who died by suicide last week. He was 47. "This is an unimaginable tragedy," the statement said, which was released on behalf of Plaza and her late husband's family via People magazine. "We are deeply grateful to everyone who has offered support. Please respect our privacy during this time." Plaza, 40, and Baena met and began dating in 2011. The two kept their personal life low profile, only confirming their May 2021 marriage after Plaza wrote in an Instagram caption that she was so proud of my darling husband. Baena broke into the Hollywood scene when he co-wrote David O. Russell's acclaimed 2004 film, I Heart Huckabees, and then continued on an arc as a writer and director. He and Plaza collaborated on films like Life After Beth in 2014, which Baena wrote and directed, and Plaza starred as the titular zombie. Plaza's directorial debut, a 2021 installment of Cinema Toast, was part of an anthology series that Baena created on Showtime. Plaza, who most recently starred in Agatha All Along and The White Lotus, was originally scheduled to present at Sunday evening's 2025 Golden Globes. Best Director winner Brady Corbett, while accepting his statuette for The Brutalist, closed his speech with a brief tribute saying, "Tonight, my heart is with Aubrey Plaza and Jeff's family. Good night." And if you need emotional support or are in crisis, please call the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. Hollywood has also had another death. David Lynch, visionary filmmaker behind Blue Velvet and Twin Peaks, dies at 78. This is by Savannah Walsh and Anthony Bresnikan on January 16th. David Lynch, the mind-bending filmmaker behind Blue Velvet, Twin Peaks, and Mulholland Drive, who merged weirdness and surrealism with the mundanity of the everyday, has died at age 78. The news was shared by his family on Tuesday, January 16th, via his official Facebook page. No official cause of death was provided. "It is with deep regret that we, his family, announce the passing of the man and the artist, David Lynch," the statement reads. "We would appreciate some privacy at this time. There is a big hole in the world now that he's no longer with us. But as he would say, keep your eye on the donut and not on the hole. It's a beautiful day with golden sunshine and blue skies all the way." Last August, Lynch refuted rumors that he would be retiring from the film industry due to struggles with emphysema, a chronic obstructive pulmonary disease that limits the body's ability to take in oxygen from the air. "Ladies and gentlemen, yes, I have emphysema from my many years of smoking," Lynch wrote on X. "I have to say that I enjoyed smoking very much, and I do love tobacco. The smell of it, lighting cigarettes on fire, smoking them. But there is a price to pay for this enjoyment, and the price for me is emphysema." The director said that he had quit smoking for more than 2 years and was in excellent shape, except for emphysema. Lynch also reiterated, "I am filled with happiness and I will never retire." Upon word of his passing, he was praised by Steven Spielberg, who cast him in a memorable supporting role in his 2023 semi-autobiographical drama as the legendary Western filmmaker John Ford. "Here was one of my heroes, David Lynch playing one of my heroes. It was surreal and seemed like a scene out of one of David's own movies," Spielberg said in a statement on Thursday. "The world is going to miss such an original and unique voice. His films have already stood the test of time, and they always will." Lynch's last known major project was a series tentatively titled Unrecorded Night. It was apparently set to shoot at Netflix, but it was among the projects canceled by the streamer during the pandemic. Sabrina Sutherland, who worked alongside him as a producer, said earlier last year that she held out hope it might still be made, but added that Lynch had been enjoying his artwork and music endeavors, so we haven't gone back to it. He also remained busy with the YouTube channel David Lynch Theater, an experimental project in which he and collaborators supplied new and absurd dialogue for vintage film clips that had fallen into the public domain. Before that, Lynch also used the channel to post two other peculiar fixtures: his daily weather report, in which he described atmospheric conditions while wearing the exact same dark glasses and black shirt each time, and something he called Today's Number Is, which featured him extracting one of 10 numbered balls from a jug. The purpose of the numbers? None can say. That's just the effect Lynch wanted. Perplexity was his favorite medium. The filmmaker dedicated most of his work to creating feelings of wonder or dread rather than making literal sense, although he was capable of surprising audiences with a linear narrative now and then, as with the 1999 drama The Straight Story. In that earnestly heartwarming drama, Richard Farnsworth plays an elderly man who can no longer drive a car, so instead, he pilots his riding lawnmower across two states to make amends with an ailing brother. Far more often, Lynch leaned into the eerie and unsettling. His breakthrough was 1977's Eraserhead, starring Jack Nance as a man whose shock of hair stands up like the rubber back of end of a pencil as he confronts a series of nightmarish images and scenarios, including having his severed head sent to a factory so it can be used to erase the mistakes of actual pencils. Lynch had initially studied fine art and painting before becoming transfixed by film in the early 70s, and Eraserhead was a student project that he began crafting while studying at the American Film Institute in Los Angeles. He was heavily influenced by the surrealist writing of Franz Kafka and sought to create equally unsettling images and stories on screen. That student film became an underground sensation, playing for years as a midnight movie and vaulting the young filmmaker into the mainstream. Comedian Mel Brooks recruited Lynch to direct the 1980 film version of The Elephant Man, based on the life of 19th century artist Joseph John Merrick, who struggled with a medical condition that made him an intriguing presence in carnival sideshows, but an outcast from regular society. Lynch later recalled meeting with Brooks, who was producing the drama, despite being primarily known for crowd-pleasing comedies like The Producers, Blazing Saddles, and Young Frankenstein. "Mel Brooks took a chance on me," he said. "All I had done was Eraserhead." Unbelievable that Mel Brooks loved Eraserhead. He backed me in ways you can't imagine. People wanted to change this, do that, and gave me all kinds of hell. Never would Mel let that happen. He protected me all the way. The Elephant Man was also a sensation. It received 8 Academy Award nominations, including Best Picture and Best Director. It won 0, Lynch noted, making his thumb and forefinger into a circle, but it didn't matter. It put me on the map. Lynch was lionized by audiences who loved his outsider storytelling. His fellow filmmakers were enamored with his audaciousness as well. George Lucas even considered hiring him as the director for Return of the Jedi. "I was asked by George to come up to see him and talk to him about directing the 3rd Star Wars. I had next door to 0 interest," Lynch later recalled. "But I always admired George. He's a guy that does what he loves, and I do what I love. The difference is that what George loves makes hundreds of billions of dollars." Instead, Lynch made another space epic, one that influenced Lucas's generation, a big-screen version of Franz Herbert's 1965 novel, Dune. Dune was not a successful picture when it debuted in 1984. The grim space saga underwhelmed at the box office and seemed to irritate critics, who described it as an intriguing mess. But it was the director's first collaboration with Kyle MacLachlan, who made his film debut in the role of Paul Atreides and would go on to collaborate with Lynch many times over the years, including on 1986's Blue Velvet and the groundbreaking surreal network TV series Twin Peaks. The actor bore a striking resemblance to the clean-cut appearance of Lynch himself, and many critics have seen his various performances as an avatar for the filmmaker. "I think he saw my face and thought, I want to throw him into weird situations," McLachlan said in 1993. "He thinks like an artist, and I think he saw me as someone he wanted to paint with." The actor posted a stirring tribute to Lynch on Thursday after news of his death broke. "David was in tune with the universe and his own imagination on a level that seemed to be the best version of human. He was not interested in answers because he understood that questions are the drive that make us who we are. They are our breath," McLachlan wrote on Instagram. "While the world has lost a remarkable artist, I've lost a dear friend who imagined a future for me and allowed me to travel in worlds I could never have conceived on my own." Born on January 20, 1946, in Missoula, Montana, Lynch never lost his flat Midwestern charm, even as he indulged in all manner of cinematic strangeness. Blue Velvet merged as his observations of mainstream American life with menacing surrealism and the brutality he saw lying in wait beneath placid everyday settings. The 1986 film was a kind of bizarre film noir, starring McLachlan as a naive college student who plays detective and tries to trace the origin of a severed human ear he has found. This puts him on an odyssey involving a cabaret singer, played by Isabella Rossellini, and a psychotically abusive drug fiend, a gas-huffing Dennis Hopper, who has intimidated her into doing his bidding. Rossellini, who starred in multiple Lynch projects and later devoted a room to the director on her Long Island farm, still remembers being cast in Blue Velvet. "He called me one day and said, 'Isabella, you want to make a film about lesbians? You like this kind of thing,'" she recalled with laughter to Vanity Fair last October. David didn't expect this film to be very successful. "I don't even know that he liked it particularly." The New York Times hailed it as an instant cult classic. Other directors labor long and hard to achieve the fevered perversity that comes so naturally to David Lynch, wrote critic Janet Maslin. "Kinkiness is its salient quality, but Blue Velvet has deadpan humor too, as well as a straight arrow side that makes its eccentricity all the crazier. There's no mistaking the exhilarating fact that it's one of a kind." Many tried to imitate Lynch's oddball perspective, but few came any close to matching it. To describe something as Lynchian is almost a cliche today, marking a work that defies easy understanding and upends perspectives on so-called normalcy. In 1990, Lynch brought his reality-warping point of view to the most mainstream of mediums, network television. ABC provided a home for his landmark drama Twin Peaks, which starred McLachlan as an FBI agent who investigates the death of a young girl named Laura Palmer, played by Cheryl Lee, in a small Pacific Northwest town. "Who killed Laura Palmer?" became a nationwide catchphrase as viewers tried to sift clues from the dreamlike narrative Lynch presented. The show only lasted two seasons, but became an enduring cult phenomenon, spawning the 1992 feature film Twin Peaks: Fire Walk With Me. It returned in 2017 for a third season that aired on Showtime, with McLachlan reprising the role of Agent Dale Cooper, still struggling to escape that woodland, trans-dimensional town. Lynch remained active on the big screen, even after experimenting with TV. Among his bigger hits was the 2001 drama Mulholland Drive, starring Naomi Watts and Laura Herring, as two women with dual identities in the highlands of Los Angeles. It's another of Lynch's projects that defies simple narrative description, blending scenes of sun-baked Southern California with inexplicable dreamlike surrealism. You have to see it to get it. And even then, aspects of it may remain a puzzle that your mind turns over and over for years to come. Watts said she learned to trust Lynch's vision. She told Vanity Fair in August, "I was coming down that escalator in Mulholland Drive and riding around Los Angeles, and he was like, 'More, Naomi, more.' I did more then. 'More, Naomi, more.' I felt like I was going to be the worst thing ever to hit the screen. But how could an adult person be that excited? It just didn't feel right. And of course, he knew what he was doing, and I just had to trust his vision and throw myself into it. Blue Velvet may have been a high watermark for Lynch, and it established another longtime working relationship. This one was with Laura Dern, who played McLachlan's sunny young girlfriend Sandy, a contrast to Rossellini's sultry and dangerous femme fatale Chanteuse. Dern appeared in several other Lynch films in the years that followed, including the 1990 twisted romance Wild at Heart opposite Nicolas Cage and 2006's Inland Empire, a reality fractured thriller in which she plays a Hollywood starlet whose identity begins to blend with her latest character. Dern was also instrumental in getting Lynch to make one of his most memorable and final on-screen appearances. At a crucial juncture, she stepped in to help Spielberg, who had worked with her on Jurassic Park, recruit Lynch to play John Ford in the final scene of The Fabelmans, a moment based on Spielberg's real-life childhood encounter with the filmmaking icon. Lynch was initially resistant, but Dern tirelessly advocated for him to change his mind. When they described the opportunity to me of David and Steven collaborating to pay homage to John Ford in this way, it was like, I just wanted all of us who love movies to have this, she told Vanity Fair in 2023. With her vouch, Lynch agreed, but he had a few conditions. One was that he wanted to have his own costume 2 weeks in advance so he could get used to wearing it. He shows up on the set, and it's filthy. It's filthy and it's wrinkled, Spielberg recalled of their shooting days. And you can really see the wrinkles where he was sitting on chairs. He really wore it nonstop for 2 weeks. His other demand? Cheetos in his dressing room. We were like, absolutely, he can have as many Cheetos as he wants, Fabelman's producer Christy Makoso-Krieger said. At the end of the day when he left, there was still a lot left in the bag, added Fabelman's screenwriter Tony Kushner, and he very politely said, can I take these home with me? Only David would ask if he could take the rest of the bag. Only him, because there's no presumption about David, Dern said at the time. It's all humility, and he makes art purely to make art, because he has to, because he needs to. All right, we're going to move to a little Taylor Swift news. This headline reads, Taylor Swift and Caitlin Clark's Chiefs game chat infuriates former Fox Sports host. This is by Eve Beatty, published on January 19th. As Taylor Swift has famously acknowledged, her presence at Kansas City Chiefs games has a tendency to piss off a few dads, brads, and chads. It appears she'll have to add at least one skip to that list after Saturday, when alleged sexual harasser and former Fox Sports host Skip Bayless had a social media meltdown when he spotted Swift in a box at Arrowhead Stadium during the team's playoff game against the Houston Texans. But this time, the anger wasn't over any perceived impact Swift might have on the gridiron performance of her boyfriend, Chiefs tight end Travis Kelce. Instead, it was a furious howl over Swift's seatmate, WNBA star Caitlin Clark. Taylor Swift arrived at the Chiefs' AFC divisional playoff game Saturday, clad in what Page Six says was, quote, over $22,000 worth of Chanel. The full look, Vogue notes, is straight from the company's recent runway show. She took a seat in her standard suite where she was flanked mostly frequently by family members. But during the third quarter, those folks made room for Clark, a game-changing WNBA star who's just finished her first year as point guard with the Indiana Fever. The Rookie of the Year actually met Kelce at her home stadium last fall when she attended the final U.S. dates of Swift's Eras Tour in Indianapolis. She's awesome, Kelce said on his New Heights podcast in November. She's a Swiftie through and through, Kelce continued. She was into the show for sure. She was there with her mom and a few friends. I think this was like her third or fourth show she's been to. She's also a Chiefs fan, Clark noted on a New Heights appearance earlier this month. I had family in Kansas City, and I grew up in Des Moines, Iowa, which is only 3 hours from Kansas City, Clark said. That's just the closest NFL team. Saturday's seating arrangement was notable enough that even the NFL pricked up its ears, tweeting footage of the two in conversation during the game. It's unclear if it was that tweet or a mention during the broadcast that set off Bayless, a veteran sports pundit who left his 18-year-old Fox Sports show, Skip and Shannon, Undisputed, in August. In January, he, along with Fox Sports and several affiliated channels, fellow host Joy Taylor and Fox Sports EVP Charlie Dixon, was sued by a former staffer who accused Dixon and Bayless of sexual harassment and battery, among other claims. We take these allegations seriously and have no further comment at this time, given this pending litigation, Fox Sports told Front Office Sports, which first reported the suit in a written statement. Bayless has not responded to requests for comment on the suit, but he has plenty to say about Clark's adjacency to Swift on Saturday. In all caps, the 73-year-old expressed his outrage, saying, "Wait, Caitlin Clark is up in the Arrowhead box with Taylor Swift? Caitlin, you don't need to be seen with her. You're bigger than she is. Just stay on your own path," he wrote in an online missive with over a million views. Even on X, which has hardly been a welcoming place for Swift, Bayless was quickly shouted down. "Maybe focus on your lawsuit and stop bothering these two women," said one. "She is a longtime Swiftie," said another. "And why the hell does an elderly man care what she does? So strange." Another Taylor Swift article from the 16th of January. Travis Kelce says Taylor Swift isn't pushing him to retire from football. Romantic relationships require teamwork, which sometimes means, as in the case of Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce, being all in on your significant other's other team. Kelce shared this week that the superstar singer is supportive of his day job as tight end on the Kansas City Chiefs, even as speculation about whether he will retire circulates. Ahead of the Chiefs' first playoff game this Saturday against the Houston Texans, Kelce sang Swift's praises as a supportive presence in his life. In an appearance on the Stephen A. Smith Show Wednesday, Kelce said he was enjoying all aspects of life. "That's for damn sure, man. Me and Taylor are happy, and I couldn't be happier to have that confidence and comfort off the field and all the support I could ever ask for in the stadium." As for whether Kelce will be back in that stadium next year, or if he'll follow in the footsteps of his older brother and New Heights podcast co-host Jason Kelce and retire, "It changes every single day, man." While Kelce said that he'll finish this season and the Chiefs' pursuit of a Super Bowl championship three-peat, a feat no NFL team has ever managed, and reevaluate, Swift is by no means pushing him to hang up his helmet and pads at the end of the season. "She's fully encouraging me to enjoy playing this game," Kelce said. "She loves coming to Arrowhead Stadium and coming to the games and cheering for me, so I got all the support in the world to keep chasing these dreams." And, he emphasized, he strives to do the same for Swift, attending as many of her concerts as he can and showing up to support her in her own career. "I'm the number one Swiftie," he says, grinning. In an appearance on the Pat McAfee show earlier this week, he even invoked one of her songs in response to a question about returning to the field for the playoffs after a few weeks' rest. "I'm fired up," he said. "I'm feeling 22 all over again, baby." Little Hollywood news. On SNL, Dave Chappelle makes a plea for empathy, whether they're in the Palisades or Palestine. This is by Karen Valby on January 19th. At the start of Saturday Night Live's first monologue of 2025, host Dave Chappelle described how Lorne Michaels first approached him in October to do the show this season. He wanted Chappelle to weigh in on the state of affairs after the election. "Ah, those were salad days when the impossible seemed possible." Chappelle's initial response? "Nah, man, I'm cool." But then he reasoned he had a bunch of Donald Trump jokes to offload, so what the hell? "The moment I said yes," he continued, "LA burst into flames. With so much of the city still desperate and reeling, and the winds getting ready to pick back up, surely it was too soon for him to tell jokes." And then Chappelle gave us that disobedient wink, the one that he so often gets him in trouble. A late bumper in the episode showed Chappelle wearing a somber expression with the word human inked on his forearm. Indeed, he spent his nearly 17-minute monologue not on arch provocation or picking at grievance. At his worst, Chappelle has been unnecessarily stubborn and willfully blind. But last night, with the catastrophe of the fires as his inciting incident, he didn't shove anyone outside of the tent he took his time setting up. Instead, Chappelle took his time crafting an argument for radical empathy, for stars fleeing their million-dollar homes clutching an Erewhon bag of overnight clothes, for the Haitians in Springfield, Ohio, for the people of Palestine. What leaps that compassion demands us to take. What a swing, with one hand on the bat and the other pinching his cigarette. The jabs were there, too. Jokes about how the news is calling the LA fires the most expensive natural disaster in U.S. history. People in LA have nice stuff. I could burn 40,000 acres in Mississippi for like $600 or $700. He talked about his loyalty to the Haitian folk living one town over from his home in Dayton. As Trump demonized those hardworking, legal immigrants this fall, accusing them of dining out on suburban pets, Chappelle says he patronized a Springfield Haitian restaurant to show support. I don't know what the meat was, but whatever it was, it fell right off the bone. Chappelle touched on Diddy and his hurt feelings over realizing why he'd never been invited to a freak-off party. Oh my gosh, I'm ugly. Moreover, if you really study my face, clearly I have snitch energy. Chappelle knew he was losing the crowd a little when he started riffing about the rap mogul's baby oil consumption as he paused to tap at his microphone. He pivoted back to the fires, musing that if Diddy hadn't been caught, there'd be a mushroom cloud over his house with all that baby oil. And then Chappelle hoisted himself off his stool, his voice turning lyrical. This Diddy nonsense, what does it matter when Monday looms and half of us will spend the day with fingers in our ears turned away from the screen while diehard MAGA warriors stand outside in the freezing DC cold? On the day that Trump becomes the 47th president of the United States, the flag will be, or should be, at half-mast for Jimmy Carter. And here was the surprise hero of Chappelle's monologue. He described being in the Middle East when Carter made a visit to Israel and decided, against Israel's wishes, to visit the Palestinian territory. I will never forget the images of a former American president walking with little to no security while thousands of Palestinians were cheering him on. I don't know if that's a good president, but that right there, I am sure, is a great man. How's that for a eulogy? So, Donald Trump, I know you watch the show. And here Chappelle flashes his impish grin. Man, remember whether people voted for you or not, they're all counting on you. Those words seemed trite on paper, but Chappelle delivered them so sincerely and with real gravity. Good luck. Please do better next time. Please, all of us, do better next time. I don't know that Trump is capable of shame, but surely this is better response to him than denial or cheap, ineffectual scorn. Yeah, it serves those celebrities right, Chappelle said at the beginning of his monologue, imitating folks griping about the LA fires. I hope their houses burn down. He paused, getting ready to flip the script. You see that right there? That's why I hate poor people, because they can't see past their own pain. Do not forget your humanity, and please have empathy for the displaced people, whether they're in the Palisades or Palestine, he said, completing his circle. Seeing past our own pain might be what gets us through the next 4 years and allows for something realer and better in the future. At the end, Chappelle wished the audience good night. By the time he remembered the job at hand to introduce musical guest Glorilla and promise a great show ahead, we'd already cut to commercials. Lorne Michaels was right. What we really needed was someone we trusted to make a little sense of the world and then tell us good night and good luck. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you're listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We're going to do one more Hollywood story that is going to pivot us into the politics section. The headline reads, Trump names Mel Gibson, John Voight, Sylvester Stallone special ambassadors to Hollywood, whatever that means. This was written by Chris Murphy on January 16th. Ahead of his second inauguration, Donald Trump is recruiting a team of elderly white men to save Hollywood. From what? We'll see. On Truth Social, the president-elect announced that he has asked John Voight, Sylvester Stallone, and Mel Gibson to serve as special ambassadors during his next administration. It is my honor to announce John Voight, Mel Gibson, and Sylvester Stallone to be special ambassadors to a great but very troubled place, Hollywood, California, Trump wrote. They will serve as special envoys to me for the purpose of bringing Hollywood, which has lost much business over the last 4 years to foreign countries, back, bigger, better, and stronger than ever before. In a statement provided to Vanity Fair, a representative for Gibson said that he found out about his appointment via Trump's Truth Social post. "I got the tweet at the same time as all of you and was just as surprised," he said. "Nevertheless, I heed the call. My duty as a citizen is to give any help and insight I can. Any chance the position comes with an ambassador's residence?" Gibson, Voight, and Stallone have all become vocal Trump supporters in recent years. In an interview with TMZ ahead of the election, Gibson, a one-time Hollywood pariah thanks to his anti-Semitic and misogynistic comments, who bounced back with a Best Director Oscar nomination for 2016's Hacksaw Ridge, said that he believed Vice President Kamala Harris had the IQ of a fence post and a miserable track record, and implied that he would vote for Trump. Voight, who is also Angelina Jolie's estranged father, has been beating the Trump drum since 2016. In October, he tweeted that we're now in a time of the darkest plague ever, and maintained that Trump was the only one who will save our country. Stallone, meanwhile, hid his support for Trump until after the election, and then introduced the president-elect at a gala, calling him the second George Washington and adding, "Nobody in the world could have pulled off what he pulled off." These three senior citizens have remained semi-active in the entertainment industry in recent years. Most recently, the 69-year-old Gibson directed Flight Risk, an action thriller starring Mark Wahlberg that hits theaters on January 24th. Stallone was Oscar-nominated for his supporting actor in Creed in 2016, but lost to Bridge of Spies actor Mark Rylance. Since then, the 78-year-old has starred in the Paramount Plus drama Tulsa King, co-wrote and produced the upcoming Jason Statham action movie A Working Man, and anchored a reality television series about his family called The Family Stallone, also for Paramount Plus. 86-year-old Voight appeared in multiple films in 2024, including Francis Ford Coppola's flop Megalopolis and the biopic Reagan, starring his fellow Trump fan Dennis Quaid as the 40th president. The three actors have been appointed at a particularly tough time for Hollywood. The recent California wildfires have ravaged Los Angeles, claiming at least 25 lives, destroying thousands of properties, and throwing the entertainment industry into chaos. Even before the fires, the industry was under siege. Variety reports that the domestic box office in 2024 was down from the previous year, as Hollywood is still recovering from the recent writers and actors strikes, as well as the pandemic. Per Variety, 2024's revenues were $8.7 billion, down 3.3% from 2023, and a whopping 23.5% from 2019, the year before the pandemic, when they reached $11.3 billion. If you're to believe Trump, a task force comprised of three men with an average age of 77 is precisely what Hollywood needs to reclaim its glory days. In a page right out of Wicked's playbook, Trump ended his Truth Social post by saying that this triumvirate will be an extension of himself, taking tabs on the entertainment industry and reporting back to the wizard, the president. "These three very talented people will be my eyes and ears, and I will get done what they suggest," he wrote. "It will be, again, like the United States of America itself, the golden age of Hollywood." Vanity Fair reached out to Stallone, Voight, and Trump's team for further comment. Moving to our next article in the politics section, TikTok is restoring service to the U.S. after Trump promises a reprieve. This is by Eve Beatty and Katie Hirschenroder on January 19th. Like Lazarus, TikTok has risen from the dead. A ban on the social media app used by more than 170 million Americans has been averted, at least for now, the company announced in a midday tweet on Sunday. The news came after President-elect Donald Trump announced he would use an executive order to extend the deadline for an American entity to take at least a majority stake in the application. The app was the subject of bipartisan legislation known as the Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary-Controlled Applications Act, a federal move that would make it illegal for service providers to enable its use within the U.S. unless Chinese parent company ByteDance sold the app to a government-approved buyer. Advocates for the ban, including Congress and President Joe Biden, held that the video sharing app threatened national security, while those in support of TikTok argued that banning it violated First Amendment rights to free speech. The ban, which Biden signed into law in April, followed a similar effort by then-President Trump, who had also attempted to ban the platform via executive action in 2020 before federal courts blocked his efforts. As with Trump's previous ban attempt, ByteDance challenged the current legislation, citing First Amendment concerns. In a separate brief to the Supreme Court, users of the service acknowledged the ongoing geopolitical tension between China and the U.S., yet argued that allowing the law to take effect amounts to a suppression of American speech and flies in the face of our history, tradition, and precedent. The Biden administration also wrote a brief to the Supreme Court saying that the law addresses the serious threats to national security posed by the Chinese government's control of TikTok, a platform that harvests sensitive data about tens of millions of Americans and would be a potent tool for covert influence operations by a foreign adversary. Since 2020, Trump has notably changed his stance on TikTok. In March, he reversed course and confirmed that he no longer supports the ban, as it would make Facebook bigger, and I consider Facebook to be the enemy of the people. There are a lot of people on TikTok that love it, Trump said then. There are a lot of kids on TikTok who will go crazy without it. That new perspective was reflected when, following his election, Trump urged the U.S. Supreme Court to delay its deliberations on the ban challenge. They didn't, and ruled Friday that the TikTok block was constitutional. In response, the Biden administration said it would not enforce the ban and would leave that up to Trump. Given the sheer fact of timing, this administration recognizes that actions to implement the law simply must fall to the next administration, which takes office on Monday, it said in a statement attributed to White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre. 90 minutes before its shutdown deadline at midnight Saturday, the app went dark, replaced with a message that read, "Sorry, TikTok isn't available right now." A law banning TikTok has been enacted in the U.S. Unfortunately, that means you can't use TikTok for now. We are fortunate that President Trump has indicated that he will work with us on a solution to reinstate TikTok once he takes office. Please stay tuned. Despite the suggestion that a Trump-backed reprieve was in the works, legislators such as Senators Tom Cotton, Republican from Arkansas, and Pete Ricketts, Republican from Nebraska, celebrated when the app went dark. We commend Amazon, Apple, Google, and Microsoft for following the law and halting operations with ByteDance and TikTok, the pair wrote in a joint statement Sunday. We encourage other companies to do the same. The law, after all, risks ruinous bankruptcy for any company who violates it. Now that the law has taken effect, there's no legal basis for any kind of extension of its effective date. For TikTok to come back online in the future, ByteDance must agree to a sale that satisfies the law's qualified divestiture requirements by severing all ties between TikTok and Communist China. The GOP senator's celebration was premature, as shortly thereafter, Trump posted a plan to reverse the ban on Truth Social, the app he co-owns. "I will issue an executive order on Monday to extend the period of time before the law's prohibitions take effect so that we can make a deal to protect our national security," he wrote. The order will also confirm that there will be no liability for any company that helped keep TikTok from going dark before my order. A few hours later, TikTok Boost's policy-focused X account retweeted, "In agreement with our service providers, TikTok is in the process of restoring service. We thank President Trump for providing the necessary clarity and assurance to our service providers that they will face no penalties for providing TikTok to over 170 million Americans and allowing over 7 million small businesses to thrive. It's a strong stand for the First Amendment and against arbitrary censorship. We will work with President Trump on a long-term solution that keeps TikTok in the United States." By early Sunday afternoon, users who opened the app received a new message welcoming their return. "Thanks for your patience and support," the screen reads. "As a result of President Trump's efforts, TikTok is back in the U.S. According to Trump, who per the AP has promised TikTok CEO Xiao Chu a prime seating location at Monday's presidential inauguration, he hopes to arrange a joint venture between TikTok's current owners and or new owners whereby the U.S. gets a 50% ownership in a joint venture set up between the U.S. and whichever purchase we so choose. By doing this, we save TikTok, keep it in good hands, and allow it to stay up. Without U.S. approval, there is no TikTok. With our approval, it's worth hundreds of billions of dollars, maybe trillions. What remains unclear is how Trump's GOP colleagues view this change of heart. On Sunday morning, before the president-elect's announcement, House Speaker Mike Johnson told Meet the Press, "I think we will enforce the law." "It's not the platform that members of Congress are concerned about," Johnson said. "It's the Chinese Communist Party and their manipulation of algorithms. They have been flooding the minds of American children with terrible messages, glorifying violence and anti-Semitism and even suicide and eating disorders. I mean, crazy kinds of stuff. And they're mining the data of American citizens. It's a very dangerous thing." Our next article is entitled, "Biden proclaims that the Equal Rights Amendment is the law of the land. But what does that mean?" This is by Katie Hirschenroder on January 18th. President Joe Biden announced on Friday that, as far as he's concerned, the Equal Rights Amendment is the law of the land, a somewhat symbolic move that's poised to allow more women across the country to sue their states for gender discrimination, including challenges to abortion bans. The ERA, originally drafted over a century ago and passed by Congress in 1972, has faced a long and hard-fought journey toward ratification and implementation as the 28th Amendment to the Constitution. If formally recognized, the ERA would constitutionalize gender equality. "The Equal Rights Amendment is the law of the land now," Biden said in a speech to the United States Conference of Mayors. "It's the 28th Amendment to the Constitution now." While Biden's declaration is expected to spur legal and political repercussions nationwide, the president's announcement isn't so simple. Immediately following Biden's announcement on Friday, the National Archives, which publishes constitutional amendments, stated it had no plans to formally add the ERA to the Constitution. When Congress passed the ERA over 50 years ago, the initial preamble required that 38 states move to ratify within 7 years. That deadline was extended to 1982. By that year, the amendment was 3 states short of implementation. Thanks to anti-abortion, anti-feminist activists like Phyllis Schlafly, the ERA was squashed. It wasn't until 2020 that Virginia became the crucial 38th state to ratify the ERA. Yet, because the deadline had long passed, and thanks to Donald Trump's Justice Department saying at the time that ratification took too long, the ERA has remained outside of the founding text. Even as about 8 in 10 U.S. adults, including majorities of men and women and Republicans and Democrats alike, say they at least somewhat favor adding the ERA to the Constitution, according to Pew. United States archivist Colleen Shogan, a Biden appointee and the first woman archivist, has repeatedly stated that the ERA's eligibility has expired and could not be added to the Constitution now unless Congress acts. Last month, Shogun and the deputy archivist released a statement saying they could not certify the ERA due to established legal, judicial, and procedural decisions. On Friday, the archives reiterated its position. The underlying legal and procedural issues have not changed, they said in a statement. Biden is also not going to order the archivist to certify and publish the ERA, the White House told reporters. Biden's Friday announcement about the ERA comes as the president has filled his last moments in office with sweeping executive measures, including designating national monuments in California, removing Cuba from the list of state sponsors of terrorism, blocking a Japanese company's takeover of United States Steel, extending protected status to nearly 1 million immigrants, and commuting the sentences of almost everyone on federal death row, as detailed by the Washington Post this week. In Biden's official statement on the ERA on Friday, he agreed with the assessment of the American Bar Association and leading legal constitutional scholars that the Equal Rights Amendment has cleared all necessary hurdles and has in fact become part of our Constitution. Even without the archivist publishing the amendment, Biden's declaration opens the door for women and pregnant people across the country to challenge gender-based discrimination in their states. As Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York pointed out in a New York Times opinion piece last month, and has frequently stated, the amendment would make discrimination on the basis of sex, like restrictions on reproductive care that single out women, unconstitutional, including, in my view, abortion. Gillibrand praised Biden's Friday's decision, telling Politico that it's the clearest pathway to challenge Dobbs holding that women in their reproductive years have no right to privacy, but arguably men do. Around half of states have their own ERAs, and these amendments have already been used to challenge abortion restrictions. In September of last year, legal groups fought against Nevada's ban on Medicaid coverage for abortion, saying that the sex-based discrimination violated the state's constitution's ERA, and won. While some advocates for access to reproductive health care celebrated Biden's announcement on Friday, others also critiqued the move as coming too late. Collectively, as a party, often we are too deferential to norms, and we take a bit too long to hash out how we're going to respond to crises like the voting rights crisis and the abortion rights crisis, Mini Timirigiu, the head of Reproductive Freedom for All, said. But, she added, I don't lay that squarely at the feet of Joe Biden and his administration. Clearly, the hope is that women will file ERA-based suits, leaving the courts to determine the amendment's validity. Jessica Valenti, author of Abortion, Our Bodies, Their Lies, and the Truths We Used to Win, wrote in her newsletter, Abortion, Every Day. What's more, she continued, Democrats want to put Republicans on the spot, forcing them to admit that they don't want to give women constitutional equality. Our next headline is Zucking Up. Trump's inauguration is a brash display of big tech's realignment. This is by Caitlin Dewey on January 15th. It is a striking sign of how far right the tech sector has swung. Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg will both have seats of honor at President-elect Donald Trump's inauguration on Monday, and Zuckerberg will host a black tie ball to honor Trump with Republican megadonor Miriam Adelson. The news, first reported by Puck and NBC News, caps weeks of unsubtle realignment at Zuckerberg's Meta and Bezos's Amazon. Earlier this month, Zuckerberg announced that his companies, which include Facebook and Instagram, will no longer fact-check user content, screen out many kinds of hate speech and slurs, or work to diversify their overwhelmingly male workforce. Bezos, meanwhile, has axed DEI programs at Amazon and in October controversially blocked The Washington Post from publishing an endorsement of then-presidential hopeful Kamala Harris. Bezos said that politics did not influence that decision. Other tech titans are also flocking to Trump's inauguration and to his political movement more generally. The leaders of companies including Google, Microsoft, Uber, Apple, OpenAI, and Coinbase chipped in millions of dollars to fund inaugural parades and parties. Silicon Valley investor Peter Thiel will host a pre-inauguration party, and the Washington Post reports, as will barons of the crypto industry. And several notable tech bros will serve official roles in Trump's administration, including the venture capitalist David Sachs and the billionaire ex and Tesla owner Elon Musk. Musk, Zuckerberg, and Bezos, in particular, will all sit on Trump's inaugural dais next week, alongside his cabinet picks and other elected officials. There's no word on whether their respected spouses are attending, and Zuckerberg's wife, the philanthropist Priscilla Chan, is not listed as a co-host on Zuck's gala invitation. All this ring-kissing and public pomp mark a stark departure for Silicon Valley, which has traditionally served as a Democratic stronghold and largely shunned Trump before his first term. But a lot has changed in the past 8 years for both Trump and corporate America. For one thing, tech CEOs have learned that the president-elect tends to favor companies with whom he has personal relationships, inspiring many to cozy up. For another thing, President Joe Biden alienated some prominent tech leaders with his antitrust and oversight policies, creating an opening for Republicans. Tech executives, business leaders, and other big donors have now donated so much money to Trump's record-breaking inaugural fund that it has literally run out of gala tickets and seats at the inaugural address for VIP donors, the New York Times reports. Per Common Cause, a nonpartisan watchdog group, this is not normal. And even ahead of the inauguration, a steady stream of business and tech leaders have made pilgrimage to Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort, to Trump's apparent glee. Jeff Bezos came, Bill Gates came, Mark Zuckerberg came. Many of them came numerous times, the president-elect enthused last week. The bankers have all come. Everybody is coming. We do not have a Levin report, but it seems that Casey Wickman is sort of filling in. Her first headline, Ivanka Trump has absolutely nothing to say about her stepmother, Melania Trump. This is published on January 15th. Ivanka Trump, despite existing for years in positions of great public prominence, unmissable thanks to the shenanigans, crimes, and presidency of her father, Donald Trump, is something of an enigma. The once and future first daughter, who served as a senior advisor during dear old dad's first term, rarely gives interviews, but sat for nearly 2 hours with the Skinny Confidential's Him and Her podcast, published Monday. She managed to stress how wonderful it was to work in the White House during the first Trump presidency, while also making it abundantly clear that she wants abso-fucking-lutely nothing to do with that place this time around. When my father was elected, I had no intention of serving, Trump said of her role during her father's first stint in the White House. But oops, sometimes you just trip over your nepotism and fall right into a job. Trump and husband Jared Kushner did not draw White House salaries, but did rake in up to $640 million from outside interests during their time. According to Ivanka, Trump asked her and Kushner to join. This was not what I set up my life for. I loved the life I was building for our young family in New York. I had an 8-month-old son when we arrived in Washington and 2 children not that much older. I feel a tremendous sense of privilege for having been given the opportunity. I'm so happy that Jared and I were able to be there to help him, she told hosts Lauren Everts Bostick and Michael Bostick. This time, it's so different because so many people are raising their hands, and I'm so grateful to them. The Bosticks, a married couple who run the lifestyle blog and woo-woo wellness brand, The Skinny Confidential, as well as the overarching Dear Media brand, proved to be an unsurprisingly sympathetic audience for Trump. They've signaled at conservationism in the past. Michael is the son of JetBed founder Gary Bostick, a longtime Republican donor, and Lauren, who considers a Don't Tread on Me flag popular with the MAGA crowd tasteful home decor, in 2020 shut down a popular Facebook group she ran for her blog when things got too heavy, in her words. That heavy content included discussions of Black Lives Matter, COVID-19, the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and more. The 60K member strong group had become, in Lauren's opinion, a hateful and negative space. She just wanted to talk about mascara, y'all. After 4 years of recalibration, as Ivanka put it, and mapping out her goals, Trump has FOMO no mo. I'll be in Florida, she said, working on being the best freaking mom I could be. When President Trump first took office, The youngest of Ivanka's three children, Theodore, was under a year old, a famously easy age for both parents to have demanding West Wing jobs. She explained that though her highest, most core value is family, my kids were much younger then, so it was easier to not be present. She insisted that while she loves making an impact, I hate politics, adding that there is a darkness to that world that I don't really want to welcome into mine. I feel super great about this decision, she said of her planned role in the second Trump presidency, which she revealed will be that of an occasional human presence with which to watch TV. Like watch a movie with him or watch a sports game, to know that he can be with me and be himself and just relax, and for me to be able to provide that for him in a very loving way as his daughter. Which, luckily for her, means she's less likely to have the ethics committee all up in her business, on the hunt for conflicts of interest, not to mention congressional investigations. Let's leave that to people like her father-in-law, Charles Kushner, the designated ambassador to France. Maybe he and Donald bonded at some big family dinner over both of them being convicted felons, a classic of the genre. The elder Kushner was among those Donald pardoned in 2020 on his way out the door of his first term, granting him clemency for the 18 federal counts he pled guilty to in 2004, mostly related to filing false tax returns. Trump also displayed a remarkable knack for serenely dropping absolute zingers and not acknowledging any discordant irony. Unlike many media with media jobs, the Bostics didn't take these opportunities to follow up. For example, Trump mentioned reading with her kids and picking up books from teen daughter Arabella's school reading list, including the classic anti-fascist tome Fahrenheit 451. The Ray Bradbury book is always relevant, but is invoked especially often in the Trump era, its depiction of self-delusion in the face of tyrannical rule feeling very familiar. Instead of offering thoughts, she moved on to how much fun it was having rereading the Animorphs series. She also shared that Arabella, 13, has been doing jiu-jitsu, the fighting discipline beloved among MAGA disciples like Mark Zuckerberg and Joe Rogan. She and her daughter have gotten into it too, prompted by Arabella. At 11, she came to me and said, "As a woman, I feel like I need to know how to defend myself, and I don't have a confidence level yet that I can do that. Can you sign me up for a self-defense class?" Ivanka recalled. My jaw just hit the ground, because at 11, I don't know what I was doing. I was like thinking about boys or something. I have no idea, but I was not thinking about being able to physically defend myself. I thought it was the coolest thing. Sometimes the most cutting way to talk about someone is to not talk about them at all. She didn't mention her stepmother, Melania Trump, once during the lengthy interview, though she profusely praised her mother, the late Ivana Trump, as an unbelievable role model for what a working woman could be, almost in mythological terms, and impossibly glamorous. Melania has also characterized herself as a working mother and is a former model who loves a look, but Ivanka seems to be pointedly adhering to, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it at all. And how about when she highlighted a major way she differs from her father without even saying his name? She spoke about her response to being criticized during what she called the most volatile time, during which people were not their best selves. For me, it doesn't feel right to be combative with a stranger on social. It's just not who I am, she said. So I took a lot of punches I just absorbed, and I didn't punch back. Sometimes I really wanted to because I had a zinger. I'd even write it out, but at the end of the day, I never pressed send, and I always felt good about that. We know that the Donald can be a little trigger-happy on the social media posts he dictates to his aides, but wait, Ivanka is passing the salt. I try to live my life in a way that models for my children how I want them to be. That's all I can do. I can't change anyone else. I can just live in a way that I'm proud of. Despite that, and having absolutely no interest in being part of the circus once more, on paper at least, Trump sang her father's praises, characterizing him as something of a 78-year-old wunderkind. The ride that we've been on is so unusual, she said. Most people who become president, they've cut their teeth on a congressional run or something state or local, and then eventually work up the ladder to running for president and maybe actually being elected. So the fact that he did it on his first go, first time out of the gate, and then we had the experience the first time that there was a 4-year break and then he's come back with such a strong mandate, it's incredible. If by first go she means ran and lost in 2000, started to run but didn't finish the homework in 2004 and 2012, then actually ran and won in 2016, then yes, great job on that first go. This brings us to the end of our time together here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you for tuning in. I invite you to join me next week when we'll have another full hour of stories from VanityFair.com. Thanks for listening and have a great week, everybody.